The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Before the podcast begins, I would like to share with you some exciting news. Louis has released a knockout second title, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Round 2 from the amazing life and times of legendary South Florida attorney Louis Ress takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s via a spell in a top-secret army department and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available now on Amazon. Just search Louis Ress. And before we start, don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Rez. I'm Jeanette Garcia and I'll be hosting the episode. Today we're on episode 28, entitled, Suppose That You Won the Lottery. Louis, your story about what can happen when you win the lottery was wild. Do you have any more lottery stories?
Oh yes, surely I do. Actual or make-believe, life is one great lottery, And here's a great lottery story. Suppose you won the lottery.
Let's hear it.
Well, Esther, my wife, was finishing getting dressed. She would be down in a few minutes. Nikki, who was her girlfriend, was now divorced from my friend Ed, the plastic surgeon, and Nikki had taken up with Carmi. Carmi was an older, stubby, wired-haired, graying, dark-complexed Israeli. And as I said, Nikki was my wife's closest friend. She had sold her half of the marital home to Ed. They had a big house. And she bought a townhouse down in South Dade. And she was living on the alimony that Ed was paying. She could never get a job. She could never hold a job. She was just emotionally unable. Mm. And our matchmaking Israeli-American friend, Ilana, had introduced Nikki to Carmi. She was like one of these matchmakers. And he had moved into her townhouse, and he was barely making a partial living as a repair and maintenance man. The three of us, Nikki, Carmi, and I, were sitting at the Tiki Bar right on the ocean on this sunny day at the Pan American Motel waiting for Esther.
And what were you doing there at the Pan American Motel?
That's a good question. I could never take a summer vacation, so we used to check in with the kids for a four-month stay. And we check in like in June and check out like in October. And we had two rooms with the balconies and the kitchen on the second floor directly facing the ocean. And we could hear the waves coming in at night.
Wow, it seems like a pretty pricey place. How were you able to afford staying there for 4 months?
Actually, it was inexpensive. Since there was no summer season to speak of in those days. Mm. Those were simple days. Mm-hmm. That was before the summer season. Mm-hmm. Everyone packed up and went to North Carolina for the summer. Mm. So
Forget it down here. Too hot, right?
Yeah, they closed up the courthouse. Mm. There was one judge on call, but the courthouse was closed. You could take a gun and shoot it down the main street, Flagler Street, not worry about hitting anybody.
Wow.
It emptied out. Actually, we had originally checked into the Pan American. It was a very fancy motel on the Motel Strip in Miami Beach. We wanted to find out if it was anti-Semitic. Hmm. It was Catholic-owned and a Catholic-oriented hotel. I had met many vacationing priests sitting at the Tiki Bar, where I was now with my friend Comey.
Did you find out if they were prejudiced against you or not there?
Yeah, well, they advertised in church vestry, so it was very Catholic. Hmm. But I did. They were always friendly and gracious and courteous, and they extended kindness to our Jewish friends with names like Cohn and Rabinowitz and Levine, who we intentionally invited over for drinks and dinner.
That's good.
We wanted to see how they would react.
Yeah, it was a test.
Yeah, we were testing. Well, they passed the test. And the 6'8" lifeguard, Paul McDonald, was teaching our kids to swim. The organist, Jack Cavallero, played our favorite song when we entered into the dining room. They always had my usual drink on the table within a minute.
Oh. Wow, that's very, sounds great. I mean, you're complete there, huh?
Right. We were completely satisfied. We checked in often after that, and each year we hosted over 30 lost souls who had no local family for Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm sure you met so many people that way.
Well, Thanksgiving was a special holiday for me because I had a lot to be thankful for. And so we always found people that didn't have family that were going to be alone, and
Oh.
we always tried to bring them, and we still do. But
That's
at
good.
that time we had about 30, and we took up a
Oh,
big
wow,
chunk of
30.
the, yeah, and we took up
That's
a
a
big
real
bit.
dinner.
Yeah,
That's
we
beautiful.
had a big chunk of the dining room, and Jack Cavallaro was playing the organ, and everybody was having cocktails and turkey.
I mean, that's what it's really all about, right? You
Right, it
know?
was wonderful. It was wonderful. And we were at the tiki bar. Well, the tiki bartender, Mike McNulty, and he was looking at me, and I was sitting there with Carmi and Nikki. And Carmi is this Israeli guy with the curly, dark, wiry hair, and Nikki is my wife's best friend, and we were having our drinks, and then there was a lull. And I looked around, and nobody was saying anything. It was a beautiful day. The surf was rolling in. The water was aqua. The air was soft, and the breeze was gentle.
Sounds
Man.
like paradise.
Sounds great, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what can we talk about? I looked at Carmi, and he looked at me, and I didn't know what to do. So I said, Carmi, what would you do if you won the lottery? I don't know why I said that. Carmi says, how much? I say, $10 million.
Oh, that's a good amount.
Yeah. And without hesitating, Carmi says, I would give it to my kids in Israel. I would set them up in business. I would buy them homes and cars. You son of a bitch. It was Nikki.
Oh.
She was red in the face, his girlfriend. She was screaming, and she was really pissed.
Oh my.
She said, I took you off the streets. You're living in my house. You're paying no rent. You don't even pay for food. Those rotten kids of yours don't do anything except ask you for money. They wouldn't care if you dropped dead this minute.
Wow.
Get out. Get out of my house. Get out of my life, you bastard. You have the nerve to put those kids before me and not give me one goddamn cent of that lottery money? You are a bum.
Wow, she laid it on him real good, huh? She was
Yeah.
upset. So what happened after
Well, McNulty, the bartender, his jaw dropped.
that?
It was
Just
like a
like mine
bolt
did when I heard this.
of It was
Wow.
like a bolt of lightning striking us. I couldn't believe what I had triggered off. Kami was visibly shaking. His voice was quavering, and he said, No, darling. I only meant to give it to the kids what was left after I had given everything to you first. You come first. Of course, you come first over everybody and everything else. Well, with that, my lovely wife, Esther, appeared, looking so summery and neat and clean. I sure would give her my 10 million bucks if I had won the lottery.
So, what was that the end of Nikki and Carney there?
Well, no. Eventually, Nikki and Carmi made up.
Oh,
But
okay.
frankly, I don't think things were ever quite the same after that. Carmi called me
Boy,
one
Lewis,
day.
with that question, you really did
I asked an innocuous question. Carmi called me one day, and he said that he wasn't feeling well, and he wouldn't go to the doctor or the hospital because he didn't have the money, but he had a return ticket to Israel, where he told me he would receive free medical care. I told him that I would pay, but to get a medical care right away to go to an emergency room. No, not Carmi,
He didn't
no.
listen, no.
Nah, he insisted on flying back to Israel. His illness had progressed without treatment.
Oh.
A week later, he arrived in Israel. He lasted only a few days, and he died in an Israeli hospital. He probably could have lived if he had sought treatment in the United States.
That's so sad. Did he end up leaving Nikki any money or anything?
No, he didn't leave anyone any money. Carmi didn't
Ah.
leave any estate. In fact, he left about $10,000 in debts. He thought that America was great. They send you plastic cards in the mail, and you could get all kinds of things. He ordered carpentry and mechanical encyclopedias to become a better maintenance man, and he never paid anything back to the credit card company.
Oh, wow. So what's the moral of a story like this, Lewis? It's quite a heavy one.
Well, we always, there always seems to be an underlying meaning to these stories. And what we learn is that what they should teach in school, think before you speak.
Oh, yes.
I should have thought a lot
before we've all been there.
I asked him what you would do. But Carmi should have thought before he spoke about his kids in Israel.
That's true. He's equally responsible.
He mouthed off and he really damaged himself.
Yeah.
And these lessons that come like Aesop's fables from my stories, they pour forth. So this is one for lawyers, pre-law students, guys that are in law school. Never admit or agree to anything unless you've fully thought it out, unless you're certain that it's advisable. Never put anything in writing. Just don't do it. And I can give you some examples. It just so happens, and by the time people hear this, it'll be old news, but Bill Cosby was a great entertainer, and he was a great Afro-American guide to families, and he believed in the family life and loving your family and having values and working hard and being honest and honorable, and he preached all those things and wrote books.
Yeah.
And then, of course, 60 women all came forth and said that he molested them, that he sexually abused them, that he drugged them, that he fondled them, that he raped them. So here's this guy that was an ideal and set a high tone for the Afro-American family life, being guilty of all kinds of crimes. He just got off, you know, just his case just was heard by an appellate court. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania reversed it. But let me tell you what happened. And when I'm talking about don't stipulate to anything. He was sued, trying to think, around 2006, some time ago, by a woman by the name of Andrea Constand. Who is Andrea Constand? Do you know?
Nope.
No, you wouldn't know. She was a coach of the basketball team, women's basketball, at Temple University. And she sued him for attempting, I think he attempted to rape her, but he molested her. And it got very vicious. And during the suit, he was caused to give sworn testimony, a deposition. And at the deposition, he was about to invoke the Fifth Amendment. You know, I refused to answer the question on the grounds it may tend to incriminate me. Well, usually, in a civil case, if you don't, if you invoke the Fifth Amendment, they hold it against you in a civil case as an admission. I don't know what they do in Pennsylvania, but I do know that the plaintiff's attorney, Ms. Constance's attorney, said, oh, no, I've got the prosecutor to agree to give you immunity. So you must answer the question because you no longer have any liability under the criminal law, and therefore you have no Fifth Amendment rights. So that was the case, I guess. So he answered the questions and admitted that he was wrong, and he settled the case with Andrea Constand for $3.38 million.
So he admitted to doing it on
He paid a lot of money. Now the prosecutor at that time was a fellow by the name of Bruce Castor. Bruce Castor said, well, I'm the prosecutor now. It's now 2006. I don't have enough evidence against Bill Cosby to convict him in a court of law in a criminal case. So I'm not going to pursue it anyhow. So I'll stipulate to let him have waive his Fifth Amendment rights, and I'll give him immunity from prosecution. And he did. But he didn't do it in writing. He did it orally. But Bill Cosby would have never answered those questions but for the fact that he believed that he had immunity. So he answered them. So now Bruce Castor says, my God, what did I do? I stipulated. I agreed that to waive immunity. Well, don't admit or stipulate to anything as a lawyer, ever, unless you have a real good reason to do it. So he blew it. And the state of Pennsylvania had 60 claims against Bill Cosby that they couldn't pursue, even though there was a civil responsibility that he has to all these people, and they have judgments against him, and he was living in a big mansion. He waived his Fifth Amendment rights based on that agreement to give him immunity from prosecution.
Wow.
And by the way, the depositions that he used, that he said, in the constant case, mm-hmm. Were used against him in the criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an example of having your Fifth Amendment rights abused. And so the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided to give him immunity that he was entitled to, and they reversed the conviction. His conviction.
I see.
So now he's free. That's the story about.
Now I get it. Now I actually understand it with you explaining it to me.
I don't think many people know about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you think it was a simple decision? I looked it up.
Yeah.
The decision was 79 pages long.
Wow.
And it was not. You think it was the seven people on the that gave ruled on that case? Seven justices of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. What do you think the ruling was? 4-3.
Wow.
So it wasn't so clear. Mm-hmm. But even then, it tells you a whole story about agreeing to something without knowing what you're agreeing to.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ever stipulate anything. Okay? Also, you should think before you speak. That's another one of Aesop's rules.
Yes.
So what do you mean? Well, if you're a politician, you can always take it back. I disremember that. I misspoke myself. I was misadvised. I told you all the things about lying.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you say something against somebody, you forget about it, but the person you offended never forgets it.
Right.
So, and you may never know what they do to get even with you.
It could be years down the line. It doesn't have to be immediate retaliation.
Something happens to you from out of the blue, and maybe you find out, usually you don't, that it was somebody that hated you for something you did to them years back.
Yeah, they held on to it.
Mm-hmm. You got to be careful. Anger, criticism, family feuds, business relationships, often giving unsought advice. My father once told his brother-in-law not to marry a woman because she had a psychiatric history. Well, he married her, and he never forgave my father.
Oh, yeah.
So he was giving advice that destroyed, it ruined his relationship with his brother-in-law.
Mm.
Employee relations. Oh, by the way, parents, if you have a child and you call your child stupid or lazy or mean or selfish,
they will never forget.
This scars the kid forever.
Oh, yeah, they'll never forget
You forget about it. The mom says, I didn't mean anything about it. You lousy kid, you. Well, the kid never forgets.
And it forms sometimes their personality, who they are.
Never forgets. To their dying day, they don't forget about what mom said about them, what dad said about them,
or
their brother or sister said about them. It's a scar that lasts forever. What else? Well, what about employee relationships? You're working with somebody and you say something negative about them. They're this, or they're not good, or they're not on time, or they don't do a good job, or they hate the company. You tell the boss, I work with John, and he's always telling me how much he hates this company. John's going to get you. What about a judge? Judge talking to an attorney, often in front of the client, says, this case is terrible, and your client's not telling the truth. And client comes back with a gun for the judge.
Yikes.
What about the military? I can tell you, military, you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. If you're an officer and you're going into combat and you've picked on some of the people that you're in your company, you've disciplined them, you made them peel potatoes, spuds, they call it, or clean the latrine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're in combat with them. You can get shot in the back more often than you get shot in the front.
Oh, whoops.
Not funny.
Yeah.
I mean, you're leading the charge, and they're behind you with an M1. You're an easy shot right between the heads, right between the ears.
Yeah.
And that's when a lot of guys are shot in the back in the military. And
I didn't know that.
The military doesn't talk about it.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that. That was as common as you're seeing.
Right. And then knowing the right thing to say. There was a case, and I'm not making this up, where the media were called in by the military in Korea, and we were told that we're going to take a certain hill. the general was having this grandstand put up for the media, for the newspapers and television. And he says, you see that hill over there? That's Hill 42.
Uh-huh.
We're going to take it, and we can let you watch. Well, the hill was full of North Koreans, and they weren't about to let us take the hill. And it was, it tunneled through the hole. So anytime artillery hit, that they were back on the other side of the hill.
Yeah, of course.
And then they came forward when the infantry came up. Well, you knew you were going to die, and they said, charge. What do you do? Some guys charged and died. Other guys said, I'm not charging there. They got court-martialed and shot. So it didn't matter. So the other one shot himself in the foot. That was pretty good. But the smartest one laid down on the ground and started screaming and yelling and went crazy and got a Section 8 and got thrown out for being psychiatrically disturbed. But those things happen about, you know, crazy stuff. You can't refuse. So I'll tell you another story about talking too much. You don't remember, I don't think you do, a woman by the name of Leona Helmsley. Remember Leona Helmsley? You ever hear of the Helmsley Hotels? It's a chain of hotels. Well, there was one called the Helmsley Palace in New York City. And it was elegant, and Mrs. Helmsley was a part of the advertising. This is the most elite thing. This is like living in a mansion, a castle or a palace in Europe. And she was a mean, mean cookie. Leona Helmsley was a nasty, nasty woman. She had no kids. She had, I think, a dog or a cat she left all her money to. She was married to a very elderly guy who I don't think he was compos mentis half the time. He didn't know what he was doing, and she was running the show. Well, she had an estate out on Long Island, I think, and there was a woman working for her, a housekeeper by the name of Mrs. Bloom, as
Mrs.
I recall.
Bloom.
Yeah, Bloom. And Leona Helmsley, who was a billionaire, she was speaking to Mrs. Bloom, the housekeeper. So Mrs. Bloom said, wow, you know, you must pay some very, very high taxes to have this home and living this style. And Mrs. Helmsley looked at it and she said, only peasants pay taxes. So then Mrs. Bloom didn't think that was so nice. Then Mrs. Bloom went out and bought something. All the food in the mansion was being delivered by the hotel. So she wasn't paying for the food. The food, the hotel was taking like it's going on in New York City now with the investigation of the cars or the apartments or, you know, with the Trump people, the Trump business. Well, the Helmsleys were doing the same thing. They took a van and brought out food from the Helmsley Hotel and used that to serve people in the mansion. She had a dance floor installed in her mansion that was paid for by the Helmsley Hotel.
Oh, of course.
So Mrs. Bloom went out and bought something. I don't know, they were short of some food or some item. She went to the grocery and she bought it, and she brought it back, and she asked Mrs. Helmsley to be reimbursed. And then Mrs. Helmsley said, you bought it, you pay for it, to the employee. Well, you don't talk to employees like that. You don't tell them they're peasants, and you don't tell them they have to pay for their own thing. So Mrs. Bloom picked up the phone.
Nice, okay.
And she had a little talk with the prosecutor, the tax people.
I have some information.
Mrs. Helmsley was charged with tax fraud. Mrs. Helmsley said, the dickens with you. I'm not copping a plea. I'm not paying penalties. And she went to trial and she lost. And she went to jail.
Wow.
That's what happens when you're a big shot and you say
you
the wrong thing.
You don't treat people well, too.
You shoot your mouth off.
Yeah,
you know?
She was not a good person to people.
So that was the first part of this, of the lesson that the in the story, the Aesop's Fables.
Yeah, no, that's quite
the second one is never delay seeking medical care. My friend Kami thought he'd go to Israel and get it free. Well, that is a big, big, big mistake. The most important thing that money can do for you is secure you medical treatment.
Yes.
That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Before cars, before homes,
it's the most
before
important
colleges,
thing.
Before jewelry, before clothes, the most important thing is medical.
Yes.
Number one. Well, when you need you have a medical need and you don't do it, don't attend to it because of money, that is a foolish mistake. And a lot of people don't attend to medical care because of emotional problems. I'll give you an example. My mother had a pact with her next-door neighbor that in the event either one of them had a problem, day or night, they would call one another and come running over and help one another. Mm-hmm. And my mother didn't feel well. She had chest pain, and she said, I don't want to disturb my neighbor. I just feel so guilty about that. I'm going to hang in. It's going to go away. And my mother died.
That's so sad.
And she died because she didn't call her neighbor.
Ugh.
So sometimes not talking is as big as talking too much. Then you have things like you don't want to complain. You have stomach pain, and it's in the right quadrant of your stomach, right lower quadrant, the right lower corner, and that could be an appendix.
Yeah, it could be your appendix,
and
yeah.
If you hold on, the appendix bursts, and then you get pericarditis, and boy, that is
murder. Yeah, you don't want that.
So a lot of guys go to the hospital, or people go to the hospital, and there's a young resident on duty, and you come in, and by this time they're inured to all the complaints people come in with.
They don't take it serious.
You come in, you say, I don't feel well. I think I have appendicitis. The worst thing you can do is tell the doctor what's wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
That doctor says, I'll show you. You're wrong. I'm right. You know. And so he says, no, you don't. Go home. And of course, your appendix bursts and you die.
Yeah.
So those are some of the things. If you have a mark on your skin and, you know, it's a black mark and you say, what the hell? Next thing you know, you find out that it spreads. That's called metastasism. When it metastasizes, it spreads. And the next thing you know, you find out that you had a malignant melanoma and you're dying.
Yeah.
And it's too late because you're delayed. Swelling, bleeding, headaches, brain tumors. You know, you can have a brain tumor and you don't know that you're having it. Mm-hmm. And that comes from you have the very minor symptoms, a headache or something. So you shouldn't feel guilty about going into the hospital.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay.
And I feel like a lot of people have that. Even people I know, they'll be like, no, I don't want to be a burden, or, you know, I just don't want to have to deal with the you know, all the hassle of going to the hospital and the doctors
the
testing.
Right.
But it's
they won't let me out. They'll find something.
But it's like, okay, what do you prefer? Do you prefer going through the process and getting better, feeling better at the end, or not doing it and ending up dead?
Exactly. But they think, oh, well, people who die come out and go to the hospital and die. Well, that's true, because they're deathly ill.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't realize.
Because they probably waited.
That's right. That's right. They're afraid of hospitals because people go there and die. Well, what happened to my wife's friend, Nikki? She died, too. She died at home. Mm-hmm. So they're all dead. Anyhow, the bottom line is you never know what to expect when you say something.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's benign. Like, what would you do if you won the lottery? If it's controversial, if it's political or religious or sexual, you better be careful. There's no such thing as a safe subject to discuss. And that's another point. So maybe I should have just sipped my drink and kept my big mouth shut.
Well, I mean, everyone's responsible, too, so... He opened his mouth, so, you know, he could have waited and paused and thought about it, too.
Right.
So I think, you know, you can't put the blame on yourself, you know. He was responsible.
Right. So Aesop would say, think before you speak.
Think before you speak. Definitely. Wise words. Thank you, Lewis. That was a great story.